Hello.
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 And welcome to Pioneers Post podcast.
Social enterprise stories and conversations from across the world.
There are lots of ways one might define a good leader, and many figures one could readily select as examples. But at Pioneers Post, we're interested in a specific kind of leader. We're looking for those leaders who are both trying to make a difference and doing business differently. These are the leaders treading that fine line between money and mission for the benefit of people and planet. So, welcome to the Good Leaders podcast with me, Tim West, founding editor of pioneerspost.com. Welcome to the Good Leaders podcast with me, Tim West from Pioneers Post. And today, my guest is Davy Clark, Managing Director of Impact Hub London, a workspace and business support network in the UK's capital that has a mission to accelerate entrepreneurial action that benefits people and planet. Davy, a very warm welcome to the Good Leaders podcast.
Thank you so much, Tim. I'm loving being here. And you and I have known each other for a long time, so it's great to have this conversation.
We have. It's lovely to get a chance to talk to you in the podcast. So, look, tell us about Impact Hub. First of all, it's actually a global network, isn't it? And you run the London branch of it, as it were. So tell us what it's all about on a global level, and then let's focus in on what's happening in London.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, the very first Impact Hub was in London. So we spawned something that is now in something like 115 different cities in 67 countries. The philosophy of the Impact Hub is it came out of community, really. It came out of, you know, the idea that when you have change makers and social entrepreneurs, that a lot of people are working very hard, they're trying to solve problems, and they're in isolation. And that by bringing people together in spaces, that you end up being more than the sum of your parts. It's about collaboration, it's about community building, mutual support, encouragement. And, you know, we all experienced this, didn't we, during COVID, that the difference that being isolated makes to us all. Sure. And so really it's come from that. But over the years, that's still the core of our philosophy. But it's grown also to providing a lot of business support for social sector organisations. To some hubs do a lot of consultancy, a lot of innovation. Every hub is rooted in its local community, but also every hub is connected to the global network. So I have the great joy as managing director of this hub. People often say, you know, people in my role, you know, you're stuck on your own, the loneliness of the CEO. But I've got 100 peers, so there's nothing that I am facing that somebody else hasn't faced or is not facing currently. And that's so enriching. But that's true for all levels of my organisation. So my comms people have peers, my membership people have peers, everybody has somebody to talk to who's going through similar stuff. And we basically learn from each other a huge amount. So,
It may sound like a cliche, but it is quite a family, isn't it? The Impact Hub family, it always seems to be.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. And actually, somebody once said to me, he was the guy who was facilitating some of our global gatherings, and he said that his partner had said to him, you know, is this a conference or is it a party? And he was like, yes. Because we all go in, we give each other hugs, we share our stories, but we also do business together, and we're very serious about the business with purpose. And we're also, you know, the parties are legendary, seriously.
Good. So look, explain on the business side then, can you explain the business more? Because I know some Impact Hubs have come and gone. Now that's not necessarily because they didn't work financially, but it's obviously a kind of robust model. How do you make money and how do you make impact and how do those things work together?
I would say there are two main parts to our business. So part of it is what we call the space business. So we provide workspace, co-working, offices, meeting rooms, event space. And that is a classic, you know, we sell space in return for money. And what we're selling really is flexibility and community. in return for, you know, we pay our rent and we get that. Interestingly, financially, it's harder to make money on co-working. It's the bigger, the more permanent offices that makes the money. But we very consciously have a mix because we like to have kind of, you know, the anchor tenants, the big players, but we really want to be accessible. So we, you know, we don't cut that part and just go for the money. We go for the impact is partly how do we get people in? And we know we've got new social entrepreneurs. We've got people who are exploring whether they want to work in the impact sector, as well as people who are much more experienced, and we often connect them. So on that side, on the space side of the business, a lot of the impact we have is partly about facilities, but it's also about connections, networks, social capital.
Yeah.
Then the other part of our business, in London, it's about 50% of our business, but different hubs do different amounts, is a mixture of business support programs, consultancy, capacity building for other organizations, including other impact hubs. But it's all kind of social impact, business related expertise of one kind or another. And it varies from place to place. So, for example, Impact Hub Khartoum in Sudan did a really amazing innovative project around agriculture for women, whereas Impact Hub Zurich does a lot of tech that they specialize in kind of social tech. So everybody really cuts their cloth to suit what works in their neighborhood.
Sure.
In London, we could go very, you know, very tech if we wanted to, you know, it's obviously, there's a lot of that about, but we very consciously asked ourselves, who's not here in the hub, who should be, and how do we bring them in? And so our programs are really focused on inclusive entrepreneurship support. That's what we do. We do a lot of fundraising for that. Some of our programs are paid by the entrepreneurs, but most of them are fundraising. So it's a mixture. We have a hybrid model, really, of paid services and fundraise services.
And can we talk money? So what sort of what sort of figures, the kind of headline figures around turnover, profitability, and is there a sort of particular impact figure that you go for as well?
Yeah, so on the money side, it's varied a lot over the last few years. I mean, you might have heard this kind of thing called a pandemic. So just before the pandemic, where our turnover was roughly $1 million. And then it dropped to a few hundred thousand. We were closed a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So we kind of went down to about 650, 700-ish. We're about to open a new space in Euston. And once that's fully up and running and going, we're expecting our turnover to end up in the vicinity of about 3 million.
Right,
so it has been a roller coaster. But the future is looking bright from a time which was a little bit, you know,
yeah,
a bit scary during the pandemic, but it's coming good now.
And of course, a lot of workspaces folded during that time.
They did.
You know, you're a workspace that also had to make an impact. How on earth did you survive?
I think a few things. One is there was a time when we were, I haven't checked recently, but there was a time when we were the most profitable impact hub in the network. That's partly because we are very disciplined. We multi-purpose our space. Central London rent is horrifically expensive, but and increasingly now we're looking at special rent deals in return for social value. So, for example, in our new space in Euston, partly we've had a really wonderful landlord, and they've been super forward-thinking and socially minded.
Yeah.
But there's a mechanism through the planning mechanism, and every council does it differently, which where the planning committee can say you have to give a certain amount of your space for social good, so social benefit or affordable. So we are the affordable workspace provider for that space. And British Land
is this the famous Section 106 agreement?
It's exactly that, the famous Section 106 agreement. So under the Section 106, we're required, we are so worried about that. No, it's beautiful because we're required to do what we want to do, which is create impact. So we have employed a community engagement manager who's already going out and about and bringing people in, you know, that question, who's not here, who should be? Well, you know, yeah. people from local college and, you know, housing estates and so on. Yeah. We can give them some free memberships now, which we couldn't afford to previously do, which is beautiful, yeah. And provide other support. So all of that good stuff. So I think it's a mixture of our track record, our self-discipline, and now this Section 106 thing that makes it really possible for us. And, yeah. you know, again, that outlines we are an impact organisation. We're not, you know, we don't geek out on space for its own sake, on workspace yeah. for its own sake. We geek out on community building and the impact we can create through that.
And I'm sorry, I interrupted you when you were about to talk about British Land as well. So tell, how has yeah. the landlord sort of played into this then?
Well, they've been really helpful. For a start, they're managing all the fit outs and all the kind of technical stuff. We are the end client, but they've done all of that stuff, which they have a tremendous amount of expertise and so on. Secondly, they've helped us financially to, we have a deal with them, so there will be a profit share arrangement with them, so we don't have to fund up front the huge amount yeah. Of cost that would otherwise entail. And also, you know, they've been sending us potential customers and clients. They're very active on that campus, the Regent's Place campus. They're very active themselves with their own community manager. So we're really talking a lot of the same language. And it's lovely for us because, you know, so often you hear about this kind of, you know, corporates don't understand and so on. And it feels like it's much more, of course, there's been some commercial conversations too, but it yeah. does feel like it's much more than lip service. With them and it's a proper right. partnership.
Because of course the Section 106 thing, I mean that's a piece of planning legislation
it
that
is.
when any new development happens, the landlord, the developer is essentially forced it to is. Do some good. And people get quite cynical about Section 106. I'm getting a bit too yeah. nerdy here maybe, but the often kind of you know, developers will build a playground or something like that and
yeah,
say, right,
yeah,
that's my social bit taken care of. It sounds yeah. as though actually what's happened here is much more meaningful than that.
Much more meaningful. And they've gone way beyond the minimum as well that
right,
they were even
right.
required to do by the council. So we're only one piece of their Section 106 on that site. But the parts that we are part of, you know, they've gone way beyond it. They've gone way beyond it in the level of financial support, the level of a deep engagement, the
yeah.
level of kind of ongoing partnership, way, way beyond that. So, yes, it's a mechanism that has helped us very much so. But yeah, we really feel that they've leant forward.
And how long have you got the new building for then? Because you don't own the building, so you don't own
no.
King's Cross. You don't, although I think you just renegotiated on it.
So we have on the Euston site at Regent's
yeah.
Place, that will be a 15-year lease starting in April 2024.
Yeah.
So we're
okay.
doing the fit out right now.
yeah.
And the King's Cross one, that's also now part of the Section 106. We haven't concluded that yet, so we will be bidding. As I mentioned, every council does it differently. So what Islington Council does is they take the lease from the landlord,
yeah,
and then they sublet it through a tender process using social value TOMS measures as the proxy for money.
TOMS being?
It's a mechanism used through the social value framework. I think it stands for, I can't remember what the T stands for, objectives, measures and strategies.
Okay.
Basically, it's things like employing somebody who's been long-term unemployed is worth, I don't know, £25,000 or whatever
yeah.
it may be. So there's a whole list of things. There's, you know, climate impacts and employment impacts and training and so on. And you basically say which ones of those are you promising to deliver, and then they add them all
yeah.
up.
So in theory, you could get booted out of King's Cross then?
In theory, we could. We think we're in a strong position because we have a great track record. And
yeah.
So, you know, we'll have to go through the process. But if
yeah.
we win that tender, and that'll be literally coming up next month as well.
Wow.
In a couple of months, we'll know. And if we do win that one, that'll be another 20 years. here.
Okay, okay. Can I ask you about investment? So obviously, you know, you need money to be able to grow and do these things. So where have you found that money from? Have you had social investment of any kind?
Yeah, we've had money from different places over the years. So, and we've also had some frustrations. And also I've worked with a lot of entrepreneurs who've had frustrations, but also good experiences too. So when we first started, we had a number of individuals who are now our shareholders who, first of all, gave loans and then converted it to equity. And that includes, you know, the people who are our current chair, Richard Evans, and various other people, the guy who's our who was our first managing director, but also Gordon Roddick of, you know, Anita Roddick's
fame.
And he's been a great friend to us over many years, and also invested in Impact Hub Global when that started up as well. So that was our kind of starting point. Then when we went through the pandemic, you know, there was some challenges. And we did get some finance from Social Investment Business, which we are in the process of paying back, and they've also been very good to us. We did have some frustration once we were trying to raise some money jointly with others in the social sector to try and buy a building. And my top kind of thing to say to investors not to do, well, there's several things, but the top one I would say is don't string us along for a year and a half and then say no at the last minute when we're led to believe it's going to be a yes,
right.
Because that just wastes our time. It would be better to have a no right up front. But that happened to us jointly, and it did make us think, well, you know, we're well known and well established in the social sector, and so are our partners, and if we're going to get a no like that, what's going to happen to others? For our entrepreneurs, we know that I know that one of the things that I think is important is there are some great funders. Like I've mentioned, has been really good, and they ended up giving us a mixture of grant and loan. People's Postcode Lottery or People's Innovation Trust, which is part of the same organization, they also have a fund which is a mixture of grant and loan, which is also a great fund. That kind of blended finance is really powerful, because otherwise what you have is quite often you end up with the same kind of financial returns required plus impact returns as well. And it's just like, it's more burdensome for a social sector organization when it should be less, especially since some of the funds in the sector are come from these dormant bank accounts and so on. Surely that it should be easier. And I have had an entrepreneur say to me, yeah, we tried to get social investment, but they wanted us to account for every coffee cup. So instead, we disguised that we were a social enterprise. We knew we were, but we didn't shout about it. And we went for mainstream investment because it was easier. And that's a shame when that happens, because there's lots of good stuff out there. But often it's to do with the individual relationships, the attitudes of the individual organisations, and how open they are to actually sharing the risk with of the course. Investees rather than putting it all on the investees.
And without naming names, because I guess you don't want to name names, you can if you like, but can you go into a little bit more detail about what happened previously? So I know that you were part of a sort of consortium of organisations who wanted to buy a building together. And I know that in the end, you know, you then had this opportunity for the Warren Street, the Euston building, and you sort of went off, and some of the others in the consortium are still looking, and I think
they
maybe are going to be
successful.
They've
purchased something, actually. Yeah, they've bought something for themselves.
So we'll hear about that at some point. But I mean, what a frustrating process to go through.
Yeah.
And it's not, and you know, and it's, and that sort of frustration is something that we often hear at Pioneers Post. We hear it again and again. Of course, we hear really positive stories of social investment as well. But but it's the same sort of frustrations that happen, that kind of, you know, a long time. And then all of a sudden, something in the computer bugs out and says, I'm sorry, we can't give you that money after all. So what?
I mean, I don't know that there was ever a really good reason given for the no, because all we'd been doing the due diligence, we'd been doing We were open about the upsides and the downsides. We were open about the risks. So it wasn't that there was new information. It was just a changed decision. That was why it was particularly frustrating. And it was a process that had gone on for more than a year, as is often the case in social investment.
Investors or one investor?
Well, that's an interesting question. So to be fair to some of the ones that we were talking to initially, there was a pandemic. Go back to that. At that point, there were some investors who changed their focuses. I understand why they did that. Of course they did. One of the challenges for us as an organization is that we're not the ones feeding hungry kids. We support the people who are feeding the hungry kids, right?
Yeah.
So we're an umbrella organization. We're a network of networks. We're a, you know, that kind of approach where in our impact is powerful, but it's often indirect.
Yeah.
And so sometimes that's more challenging to kind of make the impact case. We do, but it can be more difficult. And our partners were similarly in our kind of position as well. So I don't know if that made a difference because people were then going more for the direct immediate needs. But there were also investors who had gone beyond that, and that was more later on in the process where they were clear. So I don't know. I don't fully know what their reasons were, but we thought we had verbally done the deal. You know, I've been around long enough to know that you never count on anything until you actually have a signed contract, of course.
Yeah.
But we were talking to them as if the deal was done.
Sounds like the rug was really pulled from under your feet, basically.
It felt like that. It felt like that to us, I think. It certainly felt like that to me. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Well, I wanted to talk about you for a little bit now as well. And first of all, how did you come to join Impact Hub London and why?
Yeah, well, I'm really glad I did because I almost didn't apply. I've worked in the social sector for a while, but I then was on maternity leave and had some small children and moved out of London to the countryside and was feeling generally kind of, I was still running my own very tiny business, trying to do coaching and supporting people to do work in the social sector. But I was feeling very lonely and cut off in that way that we've talked about. And I saw this job that was about helping social enterprises to scale using the fact that we're a global network. And it was a Sunday night and I was tired and nearly didn't apply, but I did. And then when I went, I was like, oh, I want this job so much. So I ran that scaling program, the London branch of it, I got the best experience first of all. So immediately I was working with 8 colleagues in different European countries.
Yeah.
I got the sense of both the local and the global perspective that we have as an impact hub. I learned a huge amount. And I had previously been a business advisor. I'd been a social enterprise and charity advisor. I'd worked in charities. Yeah. I'd been interim director of a charity. So had a lot of relevant experience. But it added a dimension to me. And it went from there, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was looking at your background and you... in a minute I'll ask you about sort of where you grew up and what that was like, but you did an English literature and history MA at Edinburgh University. Then you moved into rail track, sort of looking after the kind of railways.
Yes.
Then you shifted into supporting asylum seekers and coaching entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And then before Impact Hub, you founded a social enterprise, which, looks very interesting, called the Outsiders Network, for people who, it says, people who feel like outsiders, to transform the pain of feeling different into the courage to change the world. So I thought that was quite a fascinating journey. Do you want to expand on some of that?
Sure. Well, I come from a family of where a lot of people are interested in social impact anyway. My My grandfather was a very senior guy at UNICEF. My mum was a writer, used to be a one of the co-editors of the New Internationalist magazine, if anybody knows that. Yes. So I grew up with that kind of being the norm for me to kind of think about social good. So when I left university, I didn't really know what I was doing. And I thought, well, railways are social good. That's a good thing. You know, it's environmentally friendly. So, and I wanted to learn management skills. And I did. I learned a huge amount. I'd had lots of different jobs in that. I was a trainee. And then I went to Europe and did some fundraising. My first ever fundraising, I raised £186 million
from the
EU for UK railways. that was quite fun. And I also did lots of operational management. I worked at Euston Station as duty station manager for a while. So I did lots of different things. I learned a huge amount about managing people, about working on shift, about... I even learned how to signal. I mean, you know, completely useless now, but I did learn how to signal. But it wasn't pressing my social buttons.
Yeah.
So I was spending a lot of time kind of soul searching. And so I left slightly riskily, not really knowing how it would work out, and trained to be a careers advisor, because I thought what I really want to do is help other people do what they want to do. That was my touchstone phrase. And that was fun, the careers advisor stuff. But then there was a placement doing careers guidance for refugees. And I was like, oh, that's what I really want. My mum was a refugee. It really spoke to me that. And it speaks to the outsiders element as well. I did that. I worked for a couple of different charities, one as a volunteer and then as a in a paid role, and then ended up working in East London. And that evolved into business support, because one of the things that, I mean, organisations like Turn, for example, the Entrepreneurial Refugee Network, which is a great social enterprise, they will also know that often doors are closed due to prejudice or lack of recognition of qualifications and experience. So one of the things we did was help refugees to start businesses. And that's how I got into business support. Then, you know, so after doing that for a bit, then I'm, as I mentioned earlier, I had my kids and moved to the countryside and, you know, was you know, spending lovely times with them when they were little, but also going slightly doolally because, you know, my brain was... One of my friends said to me once, you're like a racing car stuck in a playground. And I was like, oh, yes, you understand me. So I needed something to kind of get my teeth into again. So I did run my own business doing coaching. And then I started writing my book, which I have written but not published, which is called... It's called The Outsider's Manifesto, The Journey from Misfit to Pioneer. So it's in line with that Outsider's Network that you mentioned. And it was all about my own experience again, because I grew up in an area which was kind of mostly white, right-wing Christian, and I am half Asian, left-wing, Buddhist-leaning agnostic. So,
but you're named after a Hindu goddess, aren't you? The sort of the ultimate Hindu goddess.
Indeed, yes. Well, my mixed name, you know, a very South Asian first name and a very English surname kind of encapsulates my identity in many ways. So that was really about me discovering for myself about, you know, I could feel bad about this, I could feel left out, or I could actually say, well, what's it motivated to me to do? It did motivate me to work with people to help them to really thrive. It did motivate me to work with refugees. It worked, you know, all this motivation about social impact, it comes from that kind of place. And I can see that in so many other people. And I started reading about this and researching it. I read one book that talked about how the world's self-made billionaires, as opposed to the ones who inherited their wealth, the only thing this researcher could find in common with them was that when they were children, they were outsiders. There were so many examples of it. Now, of course, it can go the other way. If you feel like an outsider, it can shut you down. Of course it can. It can be make a lot of things a struggle. So the question is, how do you find the strength? Where do you find it? How do you stop going into fight, flight or freeze mode and start using your differences as strength. Start advocating for yourself and for others. Find your community of supporters so you're not isolated. And that's what the book is all about. That's what the philosophy is all about.
Really interesting. And you've sort of done that with individuals initially, and now you're doing it on an organisational networking community basis.
Yeah, it fits very much with the philosophy of the Impact Hub too. I think that's one of the reasons it really appealed to me. And when I joined the Impact Hub, one of the things I learned during my research, and it really chimed with me, that is that people who feel like outsiders often get on very well with other people who feel like outsiders, even if the reason you're an outsider is very different. That experience of feeling like an outsider is kind of, there's something unifying about it. And I really experienced that when I started to, I did some podcasts and talks and some writing. I wrote loads and loads of blogs about this, and I would go off to meetup groups and talk to people about it. Loads of people would go, oh my God, that's me. And they would recognize themselves and they would start to, so I interviewed one guy who had a very serious stammer, and he talked about his experience of always having less confidence. And then later on, he realized when he was meeting lots of other people who also had a stammer, he realized that he liked some of them and he didn't like some of them. And that when people didn't like him, it might not be anything to do with his stammer.
Right.
It's a really simple noticing that he had, but that was really revelatory to him, that it didn't have to be, people won't like me because of this, automatically.
Yeah.
And there were all sorts of people. There was one young woman who talked to me about her experience as somebody with autism, and how she'd also herself turned that into a business idea where she ended up talking to the families of people with autism and help them to understand how to be supportive. And she also talked about, how what was good for her was actually good for everyone. So more time in nature, less time with overstimulation with social media, and all of these things that actually, it's like, in a way, when you're an outsider, sometimes you're a bit like the canary in the coal mine. And that's not a comfortable position to be in. But also what you're, if you make something good for you, you're making it good for everybody.
Hello, I'm Tim West, founding editor of Pioneers Post, and I'm interrupting today's podcast for 30 seconds to let you know that you can get access to thousands more resources, interviews and stories on pioneerspost.com as a subscriber. Subscribing is a really important way that you can support us. As a social enterprise ourselves, we rely on the income from subscriptions so we can produce more stories that help our growing global community of purpose-driven social entrepreneurs and impact investors to do good business better. So please take a moment to find out more at pioneerspost.com/subscribe. And now, back to the podcast. I want to move on now to how you've turned some of that experience into now your experience as a leader. First of all, I guess, what are the big challenges and hard decisions you've had to make as a social enterprise leader? And has there been a particular issue, maybe a mistake or a failure that you might look at and think, okay, that was really important and I've really learned from that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there are trillions of mistakes that I've made. I think, there's two questions in there, Tim. There's the hard decisions and the mistakes. The hardest time recently was the pandemic. We were closed on and off for 9 months out of about 15 months of kind of peak COVID times. And some of the harder decisions were around, do we make people redundant or do we furlough them? We actually did decide to furlough people and not make them redundant. And we also paid their full salary, not the 80% that we got back from the government.
Yeah.
That was actually quite a tough decision to make because we weren't sure we'd survive. But I'm really proud of having made that decision. Some of the blowback, though, that happened was that the people who were still working and were therefore doing two or three people's jobs, although some of the jobs because we were closed, didn't happen, but some of the background stuff was still happening. So the people who were still doing those felt like, well, why am I working three people's jobs and those people are sitting watching Netflix? And, you know, that was really tough. But it was
it defied logic, really, didn't it? Because it was great to have the ability to have the furlough money, basically, but it put people who were willing to work in a position where they couldn't, and people who had to work in a position where they had to do the other people's jobs. So there was a lack of logic to it. That turned into a really difficult situation.
Thank goodness for it, though, because honestly, it saved us, and it saved a lot of people's jobs. And you know, the thought of making loads of people redundant in the middle of that context, where so many people were feeling precarious, I just dreaded it. And I just remember just kind of living in this sense of fear all the time. I think the other thing I would say in terms of my mistakes is also to do with my style and my preferences is my preferences. I am a big picture thinker. I like to understand what people's needs are and really kind of tailor what we do to meet their needs. But sometimes my team are kind of like, hang on a minute. You've just promised that person this different thing.
Yeah.
And what about, can we have something a bit more structured? And I'm like, yeah, okay. But look, it's really exciting. We get to work with this person. So that's a stylistic thing. Some people like what I do in that respect. And some people do find it a bit wearing, but I'm constantly kind of, they think I'm changing direction too much. There's so much research, isn't there, about diversity is strength.
Mm.
And diversity is not just about cultural and background diversity. It's also about diversity of thinking and really understanding that you need all of those things in an organisation.
Getting back to leadership and the qualities of leadership, what other qualities do you think make for a good leader? And is there any particular leader, either in our space or generally, that you point to and say, I admire them and why?
Yeah. The leader I most admire, actually, I think, in the world is Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you why.
He was a joyful man.
Yes, exactly. Very strong morality, and in the midst of some of the most challenging context, you know, where you are dealing with the deepest prejudice, with people being killed, with conflict, and then being put in charge of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which has many, many faults and weaknesses, of course it did, but what a powerful thing to say, to attempt to build a new country out of saying, we will move on, we will listen, we will hear, we will really try and respect what the experience was of our communities on both sides. And we want people to apologize and we want people to forgive. And like I said, imperfect in so many ways. You know, there are people who feel hard done by the process. People feel that justice wasn't done. There were ways that the process was corrupted, but that vision is just amazing. And then joy. And that life and that appreciation of people and the way that he would connect with individuals and care about people, that for me is beautiful leadership. Real listening,
so sort of
real,
vision,
real intention.
Joy, authentic caring about people.
And hope. And across the board, spirituality, practicality, morality, all of those things. Yeah.
On the more personal side of leadership, I mean, you talked about making decisions during COVID and how that was difficult. Have you ever experienced any kind of leadership burnout? A lot of people, a lot of leaders talk about this. A lot of people in the social enterprise world talk about it.
Yeah,
has that been something that's affected you?
Yes, it has, I'm afraid. And actually, about nearly 2 years ago now, I was always super, super healthy. And in fact, over the first 7 years of working for Impact Hub, I think I took something like 3 days off sick in total. And so I was very blasé and I hadn't caught COVID and loads of other people had. And I was like, yeah, you know, I never get sick. And, you know, and then I caught COVID and was like, I'll be over it in a second. But I wasn't. I had it for about 9 months.
Gosh.
And I had a real, and in my usual way, I tried to push through and I was like, you know, I'll just, you know, just do what I can. And every time I tried to push through, I went backwards. So I kind of felt, somebody described it to me as a health crisis. And I was like, no, I really have a really strong sense that although, of course, this is affecting my health, I really have a strong sense that my body is just saying to me, no, no, no. I keep telling you, you need to stop and you're not listening. So I'm going to make you.
Yeah.
And so I actually took a whole month off, thanks to the chair of my board who stepped in and covered my role for that month. Right. And that was, you know, after struggling with it for a long time. And that helped me kind of actually properly recover. But it was a real, you know, I know there was COVID, you could say it was that, but I have a real sense it was just, you know, it was the end of COVID. It was the moment that we knew that we were safe.
Yeah.
And okay. The new moment that I knew that I'd moved house into my new home, and it was when everything was okay, then your body goes, right, now you can get ill, you know? Yeah. And I just went, yeah.
Right. And when you look back at that now, if you were giving advice to other people in that sort of situation.
Yeah. I think my advice is, well, before you get to that moment, I guess is, I think we all know what works for us, but sometimes we don't listen to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's better if we listen to ourselves than to other people. If somebody else says, oh, you should rest more, you're like, no, 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 go away. You know, I can't, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. But if you find ways to listen to yourself, there's something really powerful and important about that. And your body and your mind and your intuition will tell you what you need to do.
Mm.
I've never known that not to be true for anybody if they really listen. And I think there are lots of ways to do that and different people will have different ways. For me, the things I have found really powerful and worked is a lot around writing. I come from a family of writers. So writing is a thing. And The Artist's Way talks about writing this morning pages as a kind of journaling, but you do it in the morning. So you're not rehearsing your day. You're setting yourself up fresh for the day. Mm-hmm. Also, I've tried writing with my left and right hands. So your right hand is all, I'm right-handed. So your dominant hand is, you know, tells you the normal stuff. And then my left hand tells me all the bullshit. It was really weird because my left hand was very cross. But sometimes, you know, I do Tai Chi sometimes. There are other ways of getting in touch and just space in nature, ways to just listen to yourself.
Yeah.
Because you know what you need to do. You know what the
And as someone who's been a business coach as well, I mean, do you have a coach or a mentor? I guess you have a strong relationship with the chair of your board, but
I do.
How do you, having been someone who presumably thinks coaching and mentoring is important, did you foolishly ignore that?
No, I've had, over the years, I've had many different coaches, different people for different times. So I don't currently have a single coach. You're right, I do have a very strong relationship with my board chair. I also am part of a peer group, though, of social sector leaders. One person's just left, so we were six and now we're five. We meet on a monthly basis. We've literally just a few weeks ago had a whole day together going really deep.
Okay.
And we have couple of hours together and we share anything we want to share, from business stuff to personal stuff to spiritual stuff, and then we give each other feedback and guidance and support. That's really, really powerful, and that's very confidential and very trusting, and we are very open with each other. And also then we can also call each other in between and just go, I need help, which we do. So that's a beautiful thing. I have had some really amazing coaches over time. When I find really great people, I often just ask them, will you be my coach? Will you be my mentor? So lots of different people at different times. Yeah, definitely.
I'm interested in the group that you mentioned. I mean, obviously that's it's confidential, but how did it come about? Because I mean, often I when people go on a course together or something like that, you form sort of smaller groups and things. But for other people who are maybe isolated leaders who are looking for that kind of thing, how do you make it happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I would start by just, again, asking yourself who you know. Who is the, even one person, who is the one person you would like to be in a group with like that? And that's kind of where it started for me, is I asked somebody, and I even talked about through Impact Hub, maybe setting one up, and it didn't quite come off. And then somebody else, I said, oh, will you be my mentor? And then he did mentor me for a bit. And then he was like, I want to start a group. And I was like, great. And so I brought in the first person into that group, and he brought in a couple of people. And so it was, it was just, who do we know who would be able to have that quality of conversation, that quality of honesty, and also have enough, we're very different in many ways, but we have enough shared experience about, you know, we are the leaders of our organization. And that experience is different from being in a different role in an organization. So that was a shared experience. That was one of the criteria that we had.
Okay. So what's been your proudest moment so far, do you think, in your Impact Hub career? And what drives you to keep going when you get these challenging times?
I'm going to give you two answers to the proudest moment. Honestly, often the things that make me proudest are about my clients succeeding. And I don't want that to be I'm not avoiding the question. Those are the things that make me proud. You know, I have had clients raise investment. I've had clients win awards. I had a team member, actually, your Women in Social Enterprise Awards, one I submitted, one of my team members, Angie Santo de Domingo, as the climate champion.
She was our climate champion, and she's a judge this year as well.
Yes, she is. And I just, the feeling that I've helped people to do what they want to do, that was back to that touchstone phrase again, that is my, you know, that's what makes me super proud. But my second answer is, I'm expecting the next thing that will make me really proud is opening Euston. It's been a long slog. We have been, actually, even before I was involved, when I was working in the programs and business support team, they were looking at property and spaces and where might we go next. So that was like 8-9 years ago. This particular space we've been in dialogue about and working on and designing for over 3 years.
Very exciting. I remember talking to you right at the beginning of all this, and exactly. And now, it's sort of, you know, I think we talked to you pre-COVID about it, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So I you know, I know it's not quite what I'm proud of yet, but I mean, honestly, I'm proud of that. And I'm proud of the way that we've done it. We've done it through collaboration. Collaboration is the way I want to do everything. I'm so proud we've done it in collaboration. I've mentioned British Land already, but also we've done it in collaboration with the Knowledge Quarter, who are going to be our partner in the space. That's an innovation district with 100 different members in our area. We're also, of course, our members will be there in the space, and we will co-create the community with them. We ran a co-creation process for the design. So I'm really proud that it's not just a building, that it, from its first, the first idea and the way that we've always engaged with it, it's always been through that kind of community building collaborative approach. That's what I'm really proud of.
So that's the next big thing, but what's the next, is there a next big thing? So do you sort of, do you spend the next 3 years thinking, brilliant, we've done it, we'll grow that, or have you got other ideas in the pipeline?
So there are several things in our minds. We really feel the urgency of the climate crisis. So we want to deepen the way that we engage with that a lot more. We've already done some good work on it. We ran a program about circular economy businesses with entrepreneurs from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. For us, again, that inclusion angle is really important. The people who are always on the sharp end of receiving, you know, are so often not the entrepreneurs who then build the solutions, and we think that's wrong. So we want to go deeper. We want to look at other net zero businesses, other circular economy approaches, and really extend and deepen that. In the New Euston space, and with our partnership with Knowledge Quarter, there's a lot of work going on around life sciences. And for us, that means inclusive health. How do we've just had COVID, we've got this crisis in the NHS, and again, it's the same people who are on the sharp end. So how do we really engage with our local communities and then partner with the big people in the area? So the AstraZenecas, the Wellcome Trusts, the Francis Crick Institute, etc., you know, who are all there, they're all Knowledge Quarter members. How do we build that connection so people are in dialogue and that they are actually taking advantage of community insights, lived experience to create local relevant solutions. So that's a thing that we're really actively working on.
Great.
And we'd like to spread our spaces around other places in London first, but I think we'll breathe for a moment and get over this one before we start.
Will you stick to London, or will you go elsewhere in the UK? I mean, are there other impact hubs in the UK?
There was one in Birmingham. Absolutely. There are. So we are Impact Hub London. So our purview is London, and London is like a world in itself, right?
It's so diverse.
It's so big. There's so much possibility and so much need. So we will stay in London, but there are other impact hubs, and we do often partner with them as well. So there's one in Bradford, there's one in Inverness, and there's a new one in Belfast. I'm very happy to say they're just starting up. One of the things I do is I'm an onboarding coach for the global network. So that means helping teams who are interested in starting a hub to do so. Because of this bottom-up philosophy we have, those teams have to be embedded in the local area, share our values and so on and so forth, and demonstrate various things. So I was the onboarding coach for Impact Hub Belfast. I'm really happy that they're coming on board.
We'll look forward to hearing more about them in due course. That's great. So look, I'm going to move on now to we end these podcasts, as you probably know, just with a series of quickfire questions. Some of them you'll recognise, some of them are new. So I'm just going to fire those at you and ask you to choose between one word and another, and we'll see where we go. So here we go. Breakfast or lunch?
Oh, lunch. Although brunch is better, because I tend to have lunch at about 11:30 and I make it kind of like a cooked breakfast.
Do you go without breakfast then?
I tend to not have... Mostly, I don't have breakfast first thing, but then I make myself eggs and vegetarian bacon.
Very good. Mornings or evenings?
Yeah, mornings now, which surprised me. I used to always assume that I would be an evening person, but I've reached that age where I'm better in the morning.
Mondays or Fridays?
Mondays.
Grants or... it's a good answer. Grants or investment?
Oh, it depends on the quality of the funder. Right. That's more important than which one it is. I mean, I'd rather have investment and a long-term relationship and be able to make the money. I don't have a charitable mindset in that respect, but the quality of the funder is more important. Partnership.
People or planet?
Oh, you can't choose between those two. Planet for people.
Local or global?
Local, so that it is for global.
King's Cross or Euston?
Oh, no. You can't make me choose between those. King's Cross is old and beautiful and has a lovely roof and is funky. Euston is Briam, outstanding, new and shiny, and is going to be amazing. They're just different.
And also, I'm intrigued that you were station manager at Euston Station as well.
Yes, I was. It's like choosing between your children. You can't really do that.
Okay, city or countryside?
City for me. But I live in the countryside with a very short commute into Euston Station, funnily enough.
Okay.
So I get the best of both worlds.
Sunshine or snow?
Snow. I love playing in the snow. I love snowball fights. I love tobogganing. snow.
Leading or coaching?
Coaching. Much more fun.
Dancing or singing?
Oh, I love both. If I had to choose, I'd pick singing. I've been in lots of choirs. I've been in a cappella groups, but I love dancing.
History or literature?
Oh, well, I studied
both.
Both. English literature and history was my first degree. Probably now history. Probably now. Okay. As long as it's well written.
I was trying to find things related to your name. So Clark Kent or Clark's Shoes?
That's hilarious. I'm going to say Clark Kent because I think everybody has a superpower. And
brilliant.
We can all find it if we have the right conditions and the right support.
Being 21 or being 31?
Oh, 31, definitely. 21, you don't know who you are yet and you don't have enough respect and you don't have enough experience. 31 is much more fun. I would even say 41. 41.
Okay. I didn't dare do sort of move up too far, but you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm actually 51, so, you know.
Okay. 21 or 51 then?
Yeah, 51. I think when I hit 40, loads of people were like, oh, you know, don't worry about being 40. I'm not worried about being 40. I'm in my prime. Yeah.
Very good. Evolution or revolution?
Ooh. Generally evolution, but when it comes to the climate crisis, revolution necessary. Yeah.
Debbie Clark from Impact Hub London, thank you very much for joining the Good Leaders podcast.
Thank you so much, Tim. I've really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Good Leaders with me, Tim West, founding editor of Pioneers Post. If you like what you hear or have comments, questions or suggestions for guests, then please get in touch via Twitter @PioneersPost or email goodleaders@pioneerspost.com.